I'm a very grateful, enthusiastic, and very, very active member of the Al-Anon Family Groups, and my name is Jack Carpenter. Good morning. Thank you for your very kind hospitality, and I want to thank Carol for the invitation to come up here and the committee for taking care of me, and Kathy for picking me up at the airport. Kathy's not exactly my host. She's not on the committee. She just happened to answer the phone when somebody said, you need to pick up the speaker, and she does service when she's asked to do it. She picked me up. I said, have you been to this conference before? And she said, no. I said, do you know how to get there? She says, I've got directions. So we're both reading the map and following, studying the directions. And finally, we wound up getting here anyway. I guess God meant for us to get here on time, and we did. I was flying out of Burbank this morning, and I get up about 3 o'clock in the morning to go catch the early flight, and got down there in plenty of time and did a little reading and got on the plane. About the time we were supposed to take off, the fog bank rolled in and buried the whole airport. We sat out in the runway for about a half an hour. They thought, well, you know, they just canceled the next flight to Sacramento, so we're going to turn around, go back, pick up all those folks, because our plane was about empty. So we went back. We were about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours late when I got here today, and I called and I left Carol a message, and she left me a message on my cell phone that said, well, I'm sure you'll get here if you're supposed to, and you may have to speak in your flying clothes. And that consists of shorts and a T-shirt, pretty much. Glad I got here in time to change and do what I like to do when I'm standing at a podium, which is represent recovery and how I feel about the program of Al-Anon and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, who's kind enough to extend their hospitality to us at weekends and conventions like this. I will be forever grateful to them for that and for some other things, which I'll get to in a minute. Coming to the fairgrounds is a throwback to my past. I walked out across the way there to go to the bathroom, and it's kind of old home week here. I can tell you a little bit about my youth, and you'll kind of figure out where I came from and what I was like. I remember going to the fairgrounds when I was a kid. You know, I was a city boy growing up. Little tract town, a little tract house in a little neighborhood. And I guess one day my folks decided we all needed to be cowboys, and we all went off to the county fair. And little be known to me, was the plan was that they were going to go there and enter me. I was about 7 or 8 years old in the Little Britches Rodeo at the county fair. I'm just going to have some cotton candy and look at the girls and have a great time. And I should have known the jig was up when they bought me a new cowboy hat and some boots. And the first I found out I was supposed to be doing that was when they led me around to the chute where you get on them critters who are designed to kill and maim little kids my age. And they said, okay, get on, you're going for a ride. I said, oh, good. And the reason I share that story with you is because I had no ambition to get on that critter, didn't want to do it. Matter of fact, I got my nose broken later that year doing that very thing, which wasn't also my first choice. But I realized today, looking back, I grew up with a lot of fear. I was afraid of a lot of stuff. But the biggest fear that I had was that you know I was afraid, so I did it anyway. I would take actions, and I'm going to share some of them with you here in a minute, that I was terrified to do. But I had one fear that was greater, and that was that you would know I was a phony or that you'd know I was afraid. That fear over that trumped every other fear, and I waded into a lot of situations that could have been very deleterious to my health and my life expectancy. That house I grew up in was a pretty wild and woolly place. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on at my house. If you missed a weekend at our house, you might have missed something big. I mean, people hung around at our house on weekends when there was not a party going on because they were afraid to miss what everybody would be talking about at the party next week that happened last weekend. It might be a big party, or it might be a gang fight or a car chase. Something was going to go on. If you weren't there, you might miss it. And that was kind of the way it was. When we had a party, it got even bigger. We would do like Halloween parties, which was really big at our house for some reason. We all kind of studio folks with the motion picture business at home, directly or indirectly, and get made up in these wild outfits and put entire graveyards in the front yard with like 20 or 30 graves with headstones and mounds of dirt and poems on for everybody who was coming to the party, and one that was dug 6 feet deep with a sign that said the uninvited with bloody handprints on it, you know. And when you came down the driveway, Dracula and Frankenstein would swing out of the trees under the hood of your car. It was a good time right out of the gate. What I remember about those things was, first of all, being relegated to the bedroom because the party was breaking out. I couldn't wait to be 21 so I could hang out there and see what I was missing, because I knew they were having a good time. None of them knew about it until the next day when somebody else would tell them. And I remember things like my mom talking about, we weren't supposed to hear it, but my mom coming as a Playboy bunny one year. And at some point during the night, she wound up without her clothes. Well, she still had her cuffs and her collar, sleeping in the station wagon in the driveway, which did not have tinted windows. We didn't have those in those days. And remembering vaguely that she was with somebody, but not entirely sure that it was my father. And at other occasions, like when my mom would have a birthday, the routine was we'd throw a big party, we'd get mom a bottle of champagne, she'd drink two glasses of champagne, go to the bathroom, pass out. Routine. This happened every birthday. They'd pick the lock, pick her up, put her to bed, and party all night without her. There were things that happened, like I remember my folks having an argument one time. We lived on a place that had a driveway about as long as this room. It was a good long driveway, and my mom racing out of the house to get in the car and speed away to get away from my dad. And my dad ripping open the hood as she pulled out and diving on the motor as she's careening down the driveway and pulling the spark plug wires out to stop her. You know, communication skills were really big in my family. And just a lot of stuff like that. There was always stuff going on. There was a fight that happened. My dad was married to a lot of women, had a lot of kids, you know, and he was never sure which one he was married to entirely, I think, because there was a lot of interaction between them. Things like he'd go back and see my mom, and his girlfriend would come over and chop the front door of her house out with an axe to go in and kill them both. And my mom got beat up by one of my dad's wives later on with a pool cue one time. And just exciting stuff, you know. The last one I'll share with you is one that happened after I moved out, and they had to relate it to me, where my dad and my stepmom were having a fight in the kitchen, and it was going to be it. She went and got the gun. She was going to kill him. She went and got his .45, going to shoot him with his own gun. Walked in the kitchen, pointed it, squared his chest from about 2 feet away, and pulled the trigger and didn't go off. She pulled it back. She said, "This thing doesn't work." He said, "Let me see that." Takes it out of her hand, clicks the safety off, shoots around through the wall of the kitchen into the neighbor's house, goes, "No, it's working fine." Safety was on, hands it back to her. Just another day at my house, you know. That fortunately, they both laughed like you did, and they had a great time over it and put the gun away, and nobody got shot. But if we were always on the verge of having something exciting happen. Now I'm going to confuse the hell out of you. Are you ready? My parents were not alcoholic, to the best of my knowledge. My parents, I came to Al-Anon. I heard you guys talking about growing up in alcoholic homes. There's a lot of us in Al-Anon that grew up with alcoholic parents. And the stories sounded exactly like that. I knew I was in the right place because of what they were saying. Except I never saw my parents, other than my mom passing out once a year on her birthday, I never saw my parents drink. It took a while being around here before I realized you guys began to share with me that what had happened is my parents had both grown up with alcoholic parents. I found that out indirectly by going, I used to spend summers with my mom's mom and her husband. He was this big Slav, Yugoslavian man. And retired from the railroad, and he's about, I was 6'5", or 6'4", 6'5", big, big man, and my grandma was about 4'6", and she had blue hair and white puffy skin, and she looked the same for all 40 years that I knew her. She never looked any different, and she drank like a fish every day, and he did too, and I'll tell you how they would have a fight. It wasn't as exciting as my house, but it was definitely interesting. She would get after him about something, and she'd chase him through the house going, "You didn't do this, and they don't want you to do that, and you did this, and you embarrassed me such and such," and going on, and he would just walk with a stone face, and he would push a lamp off a table, and it would break. And she'd go, "Oh," and do a little circle and start cleaning up the mess and give him a little distance. And then she'd catch up with him and start getting at him again, and he'd push the TV off the counter, and she'd go, "Oh," she'd stop and clean that all up. It was just his way of slowing her down a little bit, you know, just push a little something off of here and there, and she'd stop and clean it up. And I remembered something about that time that my dad, we'd become outdoorsmen now, that my dad said, if you ever get chased by a bear, the best thing to do is to take your hat off or any article of clothing and throw it at him and keep running. Because the bear will stop and completely destroy whatever it is before it continues. He was just running from the bear. Give him a little something to keep her busy and keep going. I used to spend my summers with them. What I realized after being around here for a little while is that my parents grew up banned in a home affected by alcoholism, that's all. That all of the things that went on were, I believe, were a result of how they came out of that house, and the way I came out of my house got me to you. I was sick and crazy and out of my mind. I don't know why it never occurred to me that alcoholism, among other things, could affect me in such a way to make me as unhappy as I was, that couldn't have happened to my parents. And it went a long ways towards my being able, in the course of my inventory, my steps to make amends and forgive my parents and wipe the slate clean, whether they behaved from that point on or not, which I was able to successfully do, particularly with my dad, because I really hated his behavior with all of the women that he had in his life. And, I came out of that house with some things, some practices that where I fit in my world. You know, I did things to fit in my community. I grew up in the 60s, the heavy drug culture and the hippie culture and the anti-war mentality going on, and I wound up in the service in the early 70s when Vietnam was still going on. And, you know, and I didn't fit. I'd go out with my buddies and we'd drink, and I couldn't do what they did. And it appeared to me very early that alcohol and drugs didn't do for me what I saw it doing for them. It didn't do for me what I saw it doing for my little brothers. And in order to fit in that circle of people, I had to find a way to do it. What it is, I took care of. I drove. I got them out of jails. I got them out of gang fights. I bailed them out and balled them out and straightened them out, and we moved on. It was where I fit into every organization. Even when I was in the service, we'd go out. I was in a station in a base not far from Los Angeles, and all my buddies and I would jump in the car, and we'd drive to Los Angeles, and they'd buy a load of drugs, and we'd go back to the base and sell the drugs at the barracks on payday. And, I didn't do the drugs. Didn't like them. I didn't like them. I didn't buy them. I didn't sell them. I didn't take the profit. But my gang of guys, that's what they did, and I fit because I drove the car while they were in the back seat counting out the bags and sampling the product and passing the stuff around. I got to tell you something. They take it very seriously when you get caught on a military installation, then or now, with drugs or drug paraphernalia in your car. And I would have gone to Leavenworth for the same amount of time as all of them because it was the only way I knew how to fit with these people that I hung out with. And I'd learned that in that house and learned it growing up with my brothers and my sisters, who later on in life went on to have problems with alcohol and have problems where their alcohol consumption bothered me. It sometimes, on a good day, it doesn't, but sometimes it still does because I hate to see them dying of this terrible disease. And that's what it was. And, things would happen. Like, I was involved in a lot of violence. I did a lot of exciting things. I raced motorcycles when I was 8 years old. When I was 4, I was driving quarter midget cars. I broke my nose riding rodeo when I was 8. We were always into something and doing something. It was always interspersed with gang fights, gun fights, and car chases. And I'd love to tell you that was about Hollywood, but that was just our house. I went on to do that in Hollywood later, and I didn't get shot at nearly as often, at least not with real bullets. And things would happen. I'd get in trouble with Mom and go stay with Dad. I'd get in trouble with Dad and go stay with Mom. And my mom sent me over to Dad's house one time to get a lecture for getting into fights. I'd been in an inordinately large number of fights in a little short area, and she sent me to my dad's to get a talk, and she completely overlooked the fact that Dad had been at the fight with us. Matter of fact, it was his idea, and he drove. And not only that, but my mom didn't know at the time, but her then husband, my stepdad, had been on the other side of me when we arrived and took on these 8 guys that were armed with pistols and stuff, and I was there to get the talk. And my little brothers, who've been a really exciting part of my story, one in particular, going down the street with a couple of little girls, they were a lot younger than me, and they got into a fight. And my brother picked a fight with 8 guys. I guess they insulted him or insulted the girls or something. I have that effect on people. I love dogs, by the way. It's okay. I have a 3-legged black lab and a blind chihuahua. Like, I'm still rescuing people and things, you know. My other brother comes running in the house and says, there's a fight down the street, brother's in a big fight, and these 8 guys are killing him. And we jumped in the car and went blasting out of the driveway, and it was about a quarter of a mile down the street, and there's a car there, and there's 8 young men fixing to get in this car and get away. And, I come up with a plan. I'm a big planner. I slid in behind him with my car and blocked him in so both of us could have all 8 of them surrounded. For a math major, I really had problems putting the numbers together, and it runs in my family, as you'll see in a minute. We piled out and had a hell of a fight, and it was in the pre-gunfight, gangfight days, where a gangfight consists of shooting each other as you drive by. It was just crowbars and bumper jacks, just good old family fun, And I got my back broken and my elbow busted up. My dad got hit in the face, and we were standing when they ran off. And I told an alcoholic friend of mine once when I was talking at one of these conferences that we won that fight. And he says, I was listening to you. I don't think anybody won that fight. And my future next ex-wife-to-be was watching from across the street. I actually met her that night. And she watched me almost get killed in this gang fight and stuff. And my brother picked that fight with those 8 guys, and I had to marry her. I didn't think that was fair. That's my M.O., And this was a pattern. This went on and on and on. I moved out of that house and had a couple of kids. I was married and in the service, and I came back to California to go to school and do a little bit of work in the movie business and stuff. And I'm the go-to guy for my family. All of those years that I was fitting in with my buddies, that's how I fit with my family too. When they had a problem, they would come share it with me, and I would have some wise solution for them. I can't straighten my life out, but I'm going to fix all of them. It's that insanity that I come here with. And I would get the calls, and I got a call one night in the middle of the night, and my stepmom called up, the one that was going to shoot Dad, that stepmom, and she said, your brother's gone to the bar and been in a fight, and he's come home and got the shotgun, and he's gone back to go kill somebody, and you need to go get him. I didn't even question that. Today I would go, who has to go get him? But in those days I went, of course I do. Superman is on the job. Find a phone booth, get my tights on, we're going. They did away with phone booths after I came to Al-Anon. I didn't have any place to change after that. It really wasn't necessary to have them anymore. And I went and found him. That's what I do. I found him. I got this radar built in. I can find them. I found out in recovery that they can also find me. But I could find him. And I found him, and I took his gun away, and he was in the parking lot of this bar, and he had his gun propped up on the window, and the windows were all smashed out of his van, and these guys had crashed his windows out and tried to drag his girlfriend out the window. How many of them do you think there was? Any guesses? 8. Very good. You all get a passing grade. I took the gun away, and I put it in the trunk, and I'm going back home. And he says, I'm going to go find him. I said, oh, good. Go with God. You know, I'll see you later. On the way out of the parking lot, my CB radio pipes up. We were all on radios in those days. And he says, I found him there around the back. I wheeled my little Mustang around, and this is a big shopping center, and he had gone around that way, and I went around this way. And as we came out the other side, in the middle of 5 acres of blank asphalt, everybody's gone for the night, it's 3 a.m. now, is 3 cars in the middle of the parking lot, and there's about 8 young men having a little 3 o'clock in the morning after the bar's closed beer, just minding their own business. And my radio says to me, I'm going in. Now, if you are new to Al-Anon, I will interpret that for you. That means we're going in. And that's exactly what I did. Now, I told you I'm a planner, got to come up with a plan. I'm also afraid it's got to be a good plan. I'm probably going to die tonight, but I'm going to go down swinging. So I got up ahead of steam about twice the length of this building with my little Mustang, got it up on its tippy toes and running pretty good. My plan was to go in there and slide that car sideways into one of those cars broadside and see if I couldn't pin 3 or 4 of those guys to give me a chance to get out of the car. Because as I'm going in there, I'm doing the math. It was one of the few nights I was aware of the math. And I'm trying to divide 8 guys into me and him drunk. What I'm going to do with my 7, I haven't really figured out, but I figured I could take 4 right off the bat. And I did that. I went in there hot and hard, and I turned that little car sideways, and just about the time I was at the point of no return, my radio pops up and it says, I don't think that's them. We immediately implemented plan B, which was to gather my car up, try not to run over anybody, and leave the parking lot at an exceedingly high rate of speed so I shouldn't have to discuss my behavior with these young gentlemen, who I'm sure would have taken exception to the way I was behaving, and get out of the parking lot. And, that's a funny story, and people always laugh at it. But I have to tell you the circumstances at my home that I left that night to go take that action, because it doesn't line up with what was going on. I'd love to tell you I was a 16, 17-year-old kid with a new driver's license and a new car, and I was just going to go out and do something stupid, because I did a lot of that too. But that wasn't the case. I was a veteran in the United States Marine Corps. I'd been in for 4 years. I'd come out of the service with 2 little kids and a wife, for whom I was a sole form of support. And I don't remember to this day, and I just can't seem to remember the timing of it, but it would probably occur during a period when my 1-year-old little girl had drowned in a kiddie pool in the backyard of our house in the care of a babysitter and lay by my side of our bed for a year in a complete coma, where she required 100% constant care to survive that was being provided in our home. I probably walked around her crib to go take that action, because my head, my priorities are upside down. I can't differentiate between the family coming first and my responsibilities as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a son, as an employee. I can't. My priorities are upside down. And I drove in there fully intending to take that action, which probably would have resulted in the death of one of those men. If they'd have ducked, they'd have died, because I intended to hit them and hit them hard. My hope was to pin them by their legs. If they ducked, so be it. And that was the responsibility that I had, and I didn't even consider when I started across that parking lot, because my head is, my priorities are all wrong. I didn't get that straightened out for a long time. And that behavior, this is just one incident, guys. I can't remember them all. There were a lot of them. That was one that was especially funny, and my family still kind of talks about it. And they don't talk about the disease of alcoholism, but they talk about some of the adventures that we've had. And I'll tell you the last one, and I'll get on to the recovery stuff, and that is that one of my brothers and I work in the motion picture business, and there was a big thing we had out at Lake Powell. It was actually the movie I was working on when I met my beautiful wife, Leslie, who sends you her greeting. She's home with the kids. Another story which I hope to get to in a minute. And there was a big parade of lights thing on the lake, and there was a big contest to decorate these boats. And We decorated a boat. The movie company was there. We decorated a boat, and they entered it, but everybody was too drunk to even walk down the gangplank, let alone drive the boat. Guess who drove the boat? There's 100 movie crew people on the thing. I drive. I'm the only one not drinking. One of the guys spiked the wine with LSD, and they were all taking hits off of that. It was a very colorful group when we hit the shore at the end of this parade. As it happened, we won the grand prize trophy. So they had a big banquet, a big formal banquet with the, you know, the senator's son had a yacht and all these well-to-do people and stuff, and our group came in and basically tore the place up and thanked everybody and did like Oscar Academy Award speeches from the, like lined up here. They just want one guy to say thanks for, you know, give me a prize for my boat. They got all of us. And I went off to bed and the party went on. I got a call about 2 o'clock in the morning from my boss. And he says, brother's been in a fight in a bar and the cops are looking for him. You better find him. And I did just what I always do, got out of bed, went and found him. 5 minutes, folks, I found him in a hotel with about 250 rooms. I found him in 5 minutes, and then I hid him. Did you ever try to hide a drunk? You can hide them, but they don't stay hid. I squirreled him up in a room with another guy who probably qualifies for my program, a friend of mine of many years, and said, do not let him go, and put him in the bed, and I went back to bed, and I almost got back before two cops and the producer of the movie came through the door and caught me trying to get away into my room. They said, we're looking for brother. I said, well, me too, couldn't find him. Going to bed now, and as I was opening the door, he escaped. But it was about four doors down the hallway, and everybody saw him at once. So we adjourned to my room to discuss this, these two big burly cops, and there was all kinds of allegations. They brought the guy that he beat up, who happened to be a cop also in plain clothes. They really hate it when you beat up one of their buddies. And they were out to really fix his wagon. And the cop says, well, we're going to have to take him in. Now, mind you, I was the only sober one on the boat. I don't drink. I didn't drink at the party, and I'd gone to bed early, and I'm not intoxicated. He said, we're going to take him in. And I said, no, you're not. And he swole all up there on the couch. He got about twice his size. He says, what do you mean we're not taking him in? I said, no, you're not taking him in. You just want to take him in and beat him up a little for punching out your buddy, and I don't think he needs to go in there. He said, well, what are you going to do if we take him in anyway? I said, well, I reckon we're going to break most of this furniture. And that's when they stood up, and the producer jumped up in between us and stopped them from beating the crap out of both of us. And said, you know, he's making plenty of sense, and we'll bring him in the morning. Talked him out of arresting him and out of beating me up. But you know what? I was fixing to take a beating for something I didn't do. Hadn't even been there for the fight. It wasn't about me. But I thought it was my responsibility to step in and just take control of the situation. And I just came to you guys a little bent up, that's all. During the course of that movie, I met a young lady who was to become my next wife. We'll give you the shortened version of the story. We saw each other on location, which is not uncommon in our industry. It's very hard on marriages and relationships. And I was out behaving exactly the same way that my dad had behaved, that I judged him harshly for before and after I did the same behavior. And she moved to California, and we saw each other one of the first days. Wayne, my buddy Wayne's here. Come on in, Wayne. This is our speaker for tonight, Wayne B. I hope you guys will all be here to hear him. He's one of my favorites. What was I talking about? All my wives, my overlapping relationships. That's the polite way to put it. My first sponsor called it that. I like that better than the other words. She moved to California, and on our first date, she got in a car wreck and wound up in the emergency ward. She died in the car, and she died in the hospital. And I watched both of those. I watched them cut her out of the car and went with her to the hospital, and she stopped breathing again, and I called the nurse in, and they jumped all over her and got her going again. And she did something I really didn't understand at that moment. She rolled her head over on the gurney and looked me straight in the eyes, and she said, let me go. That did not compute. That didn't hit one molecule in my brain housing group. I could not understand that for a second. Because of the gift of going to a great deal of AA meetings and hearing AA speakers talk about their disease and their recovery, I understand today, and from hearing my wife do the same thing, that what she was doing was trying to say that she would rather die than pay the price for doing it again. She'd been in lots of car wrecks. She'd been in lots of pinches. She'd been in lots of places she didn't want to be. And she describes in her talk, she says she walked into the great white light. She says, I'm here. And they said, go back. And she said, no. And they said, we're not done. You got to go back. And she came back. When she opened her eyes and saw me, it was not good news. And I didn't understand that. Well, they took her out and loaded her in my car because she didn't have any insurance. Just a little hospital in a rural community. A little bigger than this, but not much. And they sent her out with a neck brace and a wheelchair and loaded her up and said, now she's died twice tonight. They said, we hope you live near a hospital because she's not doing very well. I said, thank you so much for sharing. And we tried to decide what to do and where to go, and neither one of us, I'd been trying to find where she was living with some phantom uncle I've yet to meet to this day, and she didn't know where it was anymore either. She's drunk and she's hurt very, very badly. And I said, well, it's all right, honey, I'll take you home. I thought about taking her to a hotel. I knew they'd find her dead in the morning. She'd be an article, a little blip in the local paper. Some anonymous woman found dead in a hotel in the morning. I just took her home. Now, if you all want to think about that for a minute, did you forget? I have a wife and family at home. So I brought her home. I called my wife up and said, I'm coming home, honey. And she met me in the driveway, and we carried her through the door. A legend has it that I dropped her coming through the front door into my house. It's entirely possible. I was a little nervous bringing the girlfriend home to meet the wife and family for the first time. Some folks came in late. In case you missed it, this is not the AA talk. That one's at 3. This is the Al-Anon talk. And we are sicker than you. I did all of this cold sober. Wayne says I missed it by one beer. Hey, I had real potential, but I missed it. Didn't I? A six-pack tops. I would have made it over the top. And it set up 6 months of some very interesting living. We waited for her to die for about 3 days. She was really very badly hurt, and she didn't die. And we finally got her some medical help and got her bones. She had broken bones, and her wind tube was crushed, and her voice box was crying. She was a mess. And she started to get better and started hobbling around the house. And she describes that as some of the happiest days she's ever had. She had a new mom and a new dad and a new brother and sister and new dogs. And everything was right with the world with her. She had lots of drugs. They gave her lots of drugs when we took her to the doctor, so she didn't even need to drink. She had painkillers, and one night I was having a little glass of wine with my dinner, and I'd been taking care of her. You know, she couldn't pick her head up off the pillow. I mean, we all went to the bathroom together, drop her drawers, set her on the toilet, put her back in the bed. She couldn't even sit up. We'd all take showers together. It was just a happy little threesome. I'd hold her up, my wife would wipe her down, and they'd turn her around, she'd wash the other side, we'd put her back in her homemade wheelchair and wheel her through the house to dinner, you know. Well, now I'm having a little glass of wine. She says, I'll have a little of that. I said, no, you won't. She says, what do you mean, no, I won't? Says right here on these drugs, I read the labels. You may not consume alcoholic beverages while you're taking these drugs. I want to tell you that she pitched such a violent tantrum and embarrassed, my girlfriend embarrassed me so bad in front of my wife and kids, I gave her the whole bottle. And I want to tell you also that she behaved so well that night that we made sure she had her own bottle every night after that. One big happy family. Now she's getting better. She's starting to hobble around looking for jobs. And my wife has decided that there's a problem with our marriage, which she's sharing with my current wife, Leslie. And Leslie's giving her pointers on how to fix our marriage. And I'm telling my girlfriend to butt out with my wife. And it's all, you know, they would never believe a movie if you wrote this down. And we start going on blind double dates. My wife would set her up with some guy, and we all go out to dinner. And we're having a lovely dinner and having a little wine and just having a great evening, and somebody's rubbing my leg under the pant leg of my pants under the table. And you know, my highest ambition in life is it's not the guy. Other than that, I have no idea who's doing it. I couldn't take the pressure. She got well enough to get a job offer in Texas, and I said, Texas would be a good idea. And then to myself, I said, and it's just far enough away. And she went off to Texas, and I wound up dissolving the marriage of that first wife, which I had not participated in for most of it. I mean, I was not a participant in that marriage. I found that out from you folks in the course of an inventory working with a sponsor. She was down in Texas. Her story is that she goes someplace for 6 months. She gets promoted, and they move her to a new city. She worked in the restaurant and hotel trade, and she'd do really good for 3 months and really bad for 3 months, and they'd can her, and she's moving on. And she was in Texas for 6 months and called me up and said, I want to come back to California. I went and got her. I drove her straight through. We didn't even stop. Took my brother down, loaded her lock, stock, barrel, and cat in the trailer, and took her home to live happily ever after. Yeehaw! I got the gift. Today it is a gift of living with my wife for the last year and a half of her active drinking, which by now she had become a closet drinker. She'd been a barroom drinker, and she's got her story, which I'll give her the dignity to tell you on her own. But she moved her drinking into our kitchen and stopped going to the bars. Her problem was she was a blackout drinker, and she never knew when she went to the bar where she'd go, who she'd wind up with, or what she'd do. And she blacked out every single night. What I saw was her fall asleep on the couch. And I would scoop her up like Rhett Butler with Scarlett and whisk her off into the bedroom to put her to bed. It was very gallant. And in the morning she would crawl over to my side of the bed and grab my hair and pull my mug around to see who it was and go, she had no idea what had gone on the night before. Step number two was to examine the look on my mug to see whether she had behaved or not. And judging by that look, how bad she had behaved. And if it was really bad, her next thought was, he'll get over it. She did all the time. Year and a half, we played this silly game. She's evil, mean, and nasty. I don't even know what's going on. I'm not seeing her drink. She just got one foot in the door and one in the banana peel, and I'm fixing to shove her on out any old minute, and then it'd be really good for a while, a little bad for a while, and it was always exciting, and I just never knew what I was confronted with. And we wrapped up this movie up in Seattle or someplace, and we were having this really nice wrap party with this internationally renowned director is there, and my wife, the catering director, staggered over to the director's table and leaned over him to explain to him the finer points of directing a movie and spilled her wine in his lap. I thought all of those things were detrimental to my career, so I grounded her. By now we're into a mode that may sound familiar to some of you. We are no longer husband and wife or boyfriend and girlfriend. We are daddy and misbehaving little girl, a role which I hope not to ever live in again because I prefer being a husband and a partner. And I grounded her and sent her to the room, and she confided in me on the trip home that she had a problem with alcohol, and I said something very interesting. I said, no, you don't. The Nile is not a river in Egypt. I said, no, you don't. You just have a couple of glasses of wine a day. Just stop. You know, my experience with alcohol is if I don't like it, I stop. She would make me a cocktail when she moved in. Every night we'd have a cocktail. I'd come home, be a nice cocktail of some kind made there, and I would drink down one. Maybe I'd leave some of it. She still remembers that. There's still a grudge there. She can't understand why I would leave any of it. And I'd wake up in the morning with just this low-grade little headache thing going on, and after a couple of days, I said, you know, I get a headache in the morning after doing this. We got to stop. In her head, she said, what do you mean, we, pale face? She did not understand that at all. And she was in the kitchen. I wasn't even allowed in the kitchen because she was afraid I'd open the wrong cabinet and find her stash or her multiple glasses that were up in there. And, you know, I'd get up and she'd go, you sit right there. I'll take care of everything. She would clean the table off and make these fantastic dinners because she'd studied to be a chef. And we had lobster slippers and shrimp bisque and all that stuff. I never went in the kitchen. After sobriety, we were sitting at dinner one day, and she went to get up. She said, so are you going to pick up your plate? I said, let's not rush into this sobriety thing too quick. Because by then, I was allowed back in my kitchen. It was a hell of a mess. It was just a mess. She finally told me she had a problem, and I set about helping her with her alcoholism when we began playing bottle tag and, you know, giving the smooch to check the breath thing when she'd come in the middle of the night from the restaurant. And, you know, it was just crazy, and it was crazy-making, and I went off on location somewhere, and she got herself in another bind, and she had embarrassed me in front of my family again, and I got done. I was just done. I was coming home to throw her out, and I came home to find out she'd checked herself in to get some help. She believed that with her conversations with me, and I don't remember this, but this is her recollection, she believes that I told her that if she went to get any help that I'd throw her out. And she also believed that when she went to get help, that the logical conclusion from that would be that when I came home, I would throw her out, and she did it anyway because she couldn't do it anymore. She had spent 3 days trying to drink herself to death, and she kept waking up upset that she wasn't dead. And she called somebody, and they took her into an intensive outpatient place, and she checked herself in, and when I came home, she told me. And I thought, okay, I'll wait. I'll wait and see what's going on. And that was this last summer in July. She celebrated 15 years of continuous sobriety because of that program and because people in AAHNI who brought AA into those meetings in that little place and saved her life and changed mine forever. And she hasn't had a drink from that day to this. Now, she got this sponsor in AA. Well, she kind of had a sponsor. You know, she asked this woman to sponsor. She said, Pat, will you sponsor me? And Pat said, you know, honey, I don't sponsor losers. We don't think you're going to make it, but you can call me. Now, Pat was this person who was scary sober. You ever know anybody scary sober? That when they walked in the room, everybody stopped talking to see what was going on with them. That was Pat. When she was very stoic. She had lost her kids in sobriety, had a stroke, and had gotten sober on a table, paralyzed from a stroke, and had the subpoena to have her kids taken away, laid on her chest where she couldn't move and stuff. And my wife chose her to sponsor her because she says, if that woman can stay sober with that, then maybe I can. And I call her AA's answer to Lizzie Borden. She did not take no for an answer. Everything was going to be Pat's way. She saved a seat for Leslie at every meeting and said, you will be in it. She'd make her go shake five people's hands, and my wife hated that. And she would go to meetings, and I liked Pat right away. She scared all the rest of you, but I liked her because she was mean to my wife. after a while, my wife said to her, she says, okay, will you sponsor me now? And she says, oh, okay. This is after like almost a year of sobriety. She says, okay, I'll sponsor you, but let's not tell anybody just yet. Now, Leslie would call her every day and say, do her daily check-in. She'd call up, get Pat's machine, say, hi, Pat, this is Leslie. Didn't have a drink today. Things are going to be all right. If I just get rid of that son of a bitch, I'll call you tomorrow. And we'd hang up the phone. Her sponsor would call her back and say, honey, we don't make any major decisions in our first year of sobriety. You are extra sick. For you, it's 3 years. You can see why I liked her. Wouldn't have been bad news if she'd left in those days. We were not fond of each other in new sobriety. I was not impressed with AA. Now she has done what I want her to do that's supposed to fix everything. She's no longer drinking. She doesn't appear to be drinking. She appears to be going to meetings almost every night, staying out to coffee until 2 a.m. I think that had more to do with me than it had to do with them. She'd just soon been gone. And she's still not behaving me. She still don't mind. If she'd ever minded me, none of this would have been necessary. She still doesn't mind me today, thank God. And her and Lizzie Borden tried to 12-step me into Al-Anon. Now, they come to me and told me what my problems were and I needed to go get some help. And I said something probably none of you have ever said. I said, I'm not the one with the problem. She has the problem. Leave me alone. And they tried, but it wasn't time. And you know what? I look back at it and I realize that there's a parallel there, and that is that my wife didn't get sober one day ahead of her time. She didn't get sober until she was done. She didn't get sober until 3 days of a really determined suicide attempt with alcohol. Until she was done, she wasn't going to get it. And it wasn't my time. She got sober and it was not my time. You cannot get us there one day before we're ready to go. It's not going to happen. 8 months into her sobriety, we're fighting. It's Saturday night at the fights. We work all week. Saturday we're in the house. By Saturday night, she's calling, looking for a place to live. You know, calling her dad. He's saying, oh honey, Jack loves you. Just stay there. He had it made when they met me. They loved me because I kept her. And we had these awful fights. She came to me one day and she says, you know, my sponsor said I have to tell you why I picked these fights with you. Because it never made any sense. I never knew what they were about. They were exciting, but I never knew what they were about. I start getting an idea of what we're talking about, and then I start making points because I'm about points. You know, I make a few points and I'm starting to make progress, and she'd shift gears to something else. I never knew what it was about. She says, the reason I picked fights with you, my sponsor said to tell you, is because I want to make you mad at me, so it'd be okay for me to get in that cabinet and drink the booze that's still in there. I had 40 bottles of booze in my kitchen. I said, ah. So the next time she picked a fight with me, I said, well, time out. I think I know how to fix this. I went and got a 28-ounce framing hammer, big old claw hammer, out of my garage, and I drug a 33-gallon trash can in the kitchen, just for appearances. And I took those 40 bottles of booze out of my cabinet and I threw them up in the air and swung at them with both hands on a hammer as hard as I could hit them. My wife hadn't had a drink in 8 months. To my knowledge, she hasn't had a drink to this day. You want to know where she was? You want to know what unmitigated gall she had while I was doing that? She went in the bedroom and closed the door and called her sponsor. They weren't even hollering. They were just talking on the phone. She was working on a recovery from her spiritual disease of alcoholism, and I was destroying our home and our relationship. And I wasn't done yet. It was ways before that happened. It was another 7 months before I got done. She started making me go to AA. She tricked me. She came home and she said, the people in AA think that you are my imaginary friend. I don't know why that struck some fear deep down inside of me, but I said, okay, what do we do? And she said, I think you need to be seen with me once a week at an AA speaker meeting. And I said, fair enough. I started going to a meeting. We drove out to Simi Valley. Frank Sloan founded the speaker meeting on Saturday nights, and I loved those meetings. I loved them right out of the gate. I loved the speakers. I loved the laughter. It began to make sense to me what I was living through in my home. I began to understand just a little bit about the disease of alcoholism. And I began to understand a little bit about recovery, both theirs and mine, by hearing people share, sober people in AA share about the 12 steps of recovery and share about the disease. And I will always be grateful to those people. And I remember almost all of them that came through there and talked. They changed my life. And I started asking them on the sly about Al-Anon, if anybody knew about Al-Anon or knew where there was or if there really was such a thing. And none of them really knew anything. One of them had a cousin they thought had gone once, but then they disappeared, you know. Mysteriously, and I'd show up and they would tell me all the Al-Anon jokes. I wasn't even an Al-Anon yet, but they just needed to have a way to vent. And I finally got a hold of our central office phone number, which I was later to become chair of, and called them up and had them send me a directory, and I snuck out to the post office box every day to get it first so she wouldn't have the satisfaction of knowing I was thinking about going. And I snuck out to my first Al-Anon meeting. Now, I've been going to AA for a while. One of the things that impressed me very much was how we treated newcomers. They said anybody new in AA in their first 30 days or 60 days, and these people will stick their hand up. And I got to tell you, that did not impress me a whole lot. And I saw people, I went long enough to see people stick their hand up month after month after month and be new. And I wasn't interested in that. And I heard a speaker at that meeting who said something really interesting. He said that they'd introduced some people, and he knew some folks that were retreads in that AA meeting. And the first thing he said when he did his talk, he says, "Do you want to know who it is in this room wants to be sober more than any of you? I will guarantee you that it's those people that just stuck their hand up again. They want it more than all of you, and don't you forget it." And I haven't forgotten it, because I've seen them year after year after year come back and come back and come back. I know they want it more than anybody else. I don't know when they get it or if they get it, but I admire their fortitude. And I finally snuck out to those first three meetings, and nobody was there. I showed up at rooms, there was nobody. I was at the appointed time and the appointed place, and nobody was there. And I thought, they really are, there's like, this is really anonymous. I'm starting to think that maybe they're right. Maybe that cousin did disappear in the Bermuda Triangle with all the rest of them, you know. I finally found my way into a meeting. There were eight little blue-haired ladies there on a Wednesday night in the middle of San Fernando Valley, and I went in and I was done. It didn't matter what they looked like or who they were. I'd talked to the wives. Me and the other wives had been pitched at my wife's recovery center, and I didn't get it. And you know, they'd been beat up and stuff. I couldn't wrap my mind around that. And these little blue-haired ladies began to share stuff that sounded way too familiar to me, and I stayed. And I went to that meeting for a long time until it finally closed up as they lost their meeting space, and they changed my life. I also need to tell you that was enough years ago that I am pretty positive that almost all those little eight blue-haired ladies were younger then than I am now. It's all about perspective. I found another meeting at the end of that first week, became my home group, and I determined I was going to go there because I could ride my bicycle. I'm an avid cyclist. Now, I told you about newcomers. I don't want to raise my hand as a newcomer at a meeting. I want to be anonymous. The anonymity thing was important to me. I just wanted to fade into the woodwork, get the secret handshake, have you teach me how to make her mind me, and get away. And my problem is that I'm going to meetings that are all women. I'm the only guy in a room with 40, 50 women at every single meeting that I go to. My solution is to ride my bicycle up there and show up in spandex, glow-in-the-dark, heat-shrink, no secrets from the world, roadie bicycle suit, to be an anonymous man in a room full of 40 women. Some things just didn't connect up there, and I would drag along street clothes with me, and I would change into them at the last minute, and you know, I'd get there before them and be in street clothes, and I was the last one out, and I'd change back into my roadie suit, and I'd leave, and I'm, you know, just wanted to be left alone. I didn't stick my hand up as a newcomer because I was afraid. And after a couple of months, I realized one day that, you know what, that's my meeting. I earned my seat. They're not going to ask me to leave. I'm probably not the only guy in Al-Anon. I've seen a couple other ones coming and going, and you're not going to ask me to leave because she's sober. And I had earned my chair in there. I'd done as sick of stuff as anybody in the room. They couldn't throw me out. And I showed up in my spandex, glow-in-the-dark, heat shrink to fit, no secrets from the world, roadie bicycle suit, without my street clothes at a meeting. And this really lovely redheaded lady friend of mine, Patty, walked up and patted me on my spandex butt. She said, "You keep coming back, honey." And I did. I got in with the wrong group of people right away. I fell in with people who were in service everywhere. I had a sponsor briefly. It was another guy that kind of came and went. He wound up quitting Al-Anon and coming back and asking me to sponsor him. And on our first meeting, he told me he thought he was an alcoholic. Like, I pick him even in recovery, I'm finding alcoholics. I chose one for a sponsor. And then he disappeared, and I got this lady sponsor. And she had this thing about service. Every time a job came up, she's like, her hand would go up in the air, and she'd say, "I nominate Jack." Man, they had a lot of jobs, and I was like, okay. I mean, I got no other idea what to do. The first thing I did that was really a life-changing experience, looked like the worst thing I could possibly choose. One of the ladies at my meeting wrote a skit, and they asked me to be in the skit. And I got to tell you, I came to you guys out of answers. If I had one more, I would not have been in the skit. The skit was the lamest thing I've ever seen in my life up to that point. It was called The Garden of Life, and I played the alcoholic weed. whose job it was to seduce Miss Daisy. If you are the only guy at your Al-Anon meeting, you are going to be the alcoholic in the skit. That's the gift I bring to you today. You need to know that, and I did it because I didn't have a better answer. I did it. And we did it for an anniversary meeting of my home group. And then we went on the road. Then we did it at a district meeting. And then we began to do the convention circuit. If you travel around the archives of Southern California, if you're fortunate enough, you may find pictures of me in an alcoholic weed costume adorning the walls of the archives as part of our Al-Anon history in Southern California. And I did it because I didn't have a better answer. What I had done up to that point had not worked. My life was not working. I was an unhappy, angry, rageful man, and I needed help. And what my experience was with that is that virtually everybody that did that, we had a lot of rehearsals. We'd go to the house, and you know, somebody's husband would be there, and they'd go, "Oh, you girls have a nice time," and they'd go off in the other room while we rehearse. And all the people that were involved in that went through life stuff. They'd lost husbands and had people get drunk and had tragedies in their life, and they showed up and did the damn show. They did the rehearsals, and they showed up and they showed up and they showed up. And all those people that did that, we formed a bond in the service commitment that long outlasted that anything that skit would ever do, that took me well into my recovery. My sponsor was part of that skit. And it's a life-changing experience to watch people walk with dignity and grace through things that are not fun. That it isn't all roses and sunshine after you get to recovery, that life happens here. What we get here is tools to deal with it better. And I've certainly been blessed with that. And I went off to do a lot of service. They took me a lot of places. At my first intergroup meeting, which I was later to become chair of, unwillingly, I didn't say no, but I was really hoping to be voted out. It was a meeting hall about this size, and it was almost full, and it was people from the 430-odd groups we had in Southern California then. And the chairwoman was newly elected, asked me to read the 12 traditions. Now, I just told you how I grew up, rough and tumble. I used to do stuff. I was in an organization when I was a kid where I would oversee great big public functions with thousands of people, and I'd be locked up there. She asked me to read the 12 traditions, and I knew you could hear my knees banging together in the back row. I'm thinking, don't lock your knees, you'll pass out. Don't lock your knees, you'll pass out. And I'm reading the 12 traditions, you know. And that was my start in the service outside the group, and I went places and I learned an awful lot. And my sponsor would make me go greet the newcomers. You know, I'm the only guy there. I watched them. The newcomers would come into those meetings, those women, and at break time, they went up and they got them. They gave them phone numbers and they talked to them. And my sponsor would tell me, a guy comes to the door. She goes, "There's a newcomer guy over there. You go get him. You go talk to him." And I still got the voices in my head. You remember the voices? I know if I talk long enough, one of them is going to get loose and I'm going to scare this guy off and he's going to die or something. I don't want responsibility for anybody. The only thing I can think to say to him is walk over and shake their hand and say, "Hi, I'm Jack. Keep coming back." And I go, "Sit down. I'm going to be keep coming back Jack for the next 25 years. So one day out of desperation, I followed my sponsor over where she met a newcomer, and she walked over to the newcomer and introduced herself. She said, "Honey, what brings you to Al-Anon?" It was a staggering question. And the answers have been amazing. And I started doing that. You'd be amazed at the answers that you get. I show up at the meetings early still. I just do it for a different reason. I do it because I'm the only one that sets the chairs up right. If you still have a defective character, we put you to work in Al-Anon. I had guys, one guy, my favorite, he came across the parking lot, and by now there's guys showing up. My sponsor said, "If you're in that chair every week and doing this deal, guys are going to show up here and they're going to stay. And furthermore, they're going to ask you to sponsor them, so you better get busy on the steps." That scared me to death. I got busy, you know. And now I'm showing up at meetings and all my guys are showing up, I'm sponsoring all these guys, and there's other guys coming, and you show up at our meeting, it was like a men's stag out front. There's like a third to half of those meetings are guys now. And this guy shows up, it's all guys out front, he marches right up to the middle of the group, and he says, "Is this Al-Anon?" We said, "Yes, it is." He said, "I'm here to find out the name of that stuff you grind up in their food that makes them puke when they drink." I liked him right away, and I had an involuntary reflex. I said, "You mean anabuse?" That was a word I was trying to get back, and he turned on his heels and headed across the parking lot. I went, "Whoa, buddy." I chased him down and said, "Well, we got to talk." I pulled him aside and said, "You know, you can seriously damage somebody with that." When you ask somebody a question like that and they've lived in a house where you don't tell the truth because you can't tell the truth and nobody's ever direct and nobody directly approaches a problem, when you ask somebody what brings them to Al-Anon, they're stunned for a second. And there's a pretty good chance they'll tell you the truth. And you know what? It's part of us allowing them to come to us and have some similarities that they can identify with so that we can recover together. And I went a lot of places. A lot of things have happened to me in recovery, and I'm going to get down to what's going on now. I've been around Al-Anon now, so you don't have to do the math. My wife's 15 years sober. I was 13 last February, 13 years in Al-Anon. I've been very active since I got here. I go to 4 or 5 meetings a week and at least one regular AA speaker meeting, which is still my commitment to my wife and my relationship and my own recovery. And I do it with great joy on Saturday nights, a meeting that my wife started. And I hear giants in AA who have come through and talked to us over the years and just been marvelous. But, you know, things happen in recovery, and some stuff has happened to us. And I'd love to tell you that I got the same talk that I've had ever since I started getting microphones shoved in front of me. And every time I think I've got it figured out what it's supposed to be and try and make a little sense of it so it would flow nicely. And there would be a beginning and a middle and the end and some little thread that would just tie it together and you'd all fall out of your chairs with spiritual growth at the end of the meeting. God keeps giving me new stuff to put in. In 1999, I spoke at a conference, and they were kind enough to have my wife come with, and it was on 4th of July weekend. It was in Southern California, one of the biggest conferences, like 4,000 or 5,000 people come to this thing, and I was supposed to be the closing Al-Anon speaker on Monday morning, and Sunday morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up for no good reason. My wife has been ill ever since I've known her, and a lot of it has to do with her drugs and alcohol abuse, the things that she did to her body. She doesn't sleep at night very well, and she's up and down a lot. And I'm a light sleeper. My world was violent. I'm a light sleeper. If I hear anything that's out of the ordinary, I'm awake. But I don't hear her. I've become immune to her comings and goings. I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning and she wasn't in bed. And I have no reason to tell you why I did this, but I leaped out of bed. I ran to the bathroom and I found her dead on the bathroal floor. She'd had a grand mal seizure, which we didn't understand then. We understand a little bit about what happened now. And she had gone down and hit her head pretty bad and had drowned in a pool of her own blood and had no pulse and no respiration. And I drug her out and threw her up on the bed and did CPR to her and brought her back. And she has shared many times from podiums that she will be indebted to me forever. I just still love, I let that wash over me when she said it. And I called the front desk and I got her going. I'm yelling at her, Leslie, breathe. Leslie, listen to me, breathe. She's choking and gagging and she has no idea what's going on. I get the front desk and there's an AA convention with 5,000 people. And I said, they answered on one ring at 4 o'clock in the morning on the 4th of July. And I said, my wife's collapsed. I need an ambulance. They said, paramedics are in the building. They're on the way. Because anytime they have a convention over a certain number of people, their policy at the hotel is to have paramedics on staff, because who do you think goes there when we're not there? Of course, they're going to get drunk tonight, and they're going to beat each other up, and there's going to be violence and excitement and car wrecks and stuff, and for their own liability, they keep them on staff. Even though we're 5,000 people in recovery, they happen to be there. They came running through the door with 2 house detectives, 2 paramedics, 2 front desk staff. My wife is now sitting up in bed. She's got a broken nose, a knot on her head. She's bleeding and disoriented and naked. She's covered in a blanket. And they're asking her questions like, what happened? What happened? What happened? She said, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. She didn't know. They said, well, what do you remember? She said, I remember my husband yelling at me. So the house dick steps out of the room, keys the radio, and says, we've got a domestic violence call here. I turn to the paramedic. I said, take me to jail. I don't care. Just take care of her. And my talk that Monday wasn't the one I thought it was going to do. It got to be different. What's going on now is this. My wife and I are both very busy in our programs. I just took another long-term commitment for my group to go back to intergroup to be a rep because I was out of a job temporarily. It's time to go do something. I like those commitments because I can do them long-term. I don't have to be at every meeting because my work schedule doesn't allow me to, but I can still be a service to my meeting by going to our intergroup meetings and reporting back and carrying information and stuff. And it's a privilege to do that anytime. A privilege that they allow me to do that. And I sponsor a lot of guys in Al-Anon, and they sponsor a lot of guys. I bring you greetings from my home group. It's the Thursday night La Cañada, 7 o'clock, Let's Rock, men's Al-Anon family group, where on Thursday night you will see between 60 and 70 men in Al-Anon have an Al-Anon meeting. And if I'm not mistaken, we just recently did something that I don't think anybody's ever done. We may be the very first men's stag Al-Anon meeting in the country that has child care. We have babysitting. We had a guy come in that was... He was bigger than you, Wayne, and wider, and looked pretty mean and angry. And he had to leave because he had a little boy with him. And we changed our policy right after that. And and institute child care. He came back Thursday night for the first time and brought his little boy and put him in child care and got to stay. He's got a wife in rehab for the seventh time. He belongs with us. We needed to have child care so that he could come to us and some others could do it. And I'm really proud of those guys. They teach me how to live. And he shared about that, and I'm sponsoring the guy a week. He came into a meeting. I knew him from my workplace, and he asked me to sponsor him, and his wife's in rehab for time five. And he's been calling me every day for a week, and Thursday night this guy comes in and shares his wife is in number seven. He's crying like a baby. And when the meeting's over, my sponsor, he comes over to talk to me. I said, "Nope, not me, pal. You need to go talk to him." And he went right by me and went and talked to that guy. He doesn't understand why, but I do, and you probably do too. He went over there to say, "Me too. I don't look like you. I couldn't possibly have lived your life, but me too, and you're in the right place. If you stick around long enough, you'll get to know that like I know that, because that's the magic here." What my wife does in service is she sponsors a lot of women in AA. She has a phone growing out of her ear. I do not have the patience for the phone. I do it because I have to. My phone conversations are structured and limited, and when I'm done, I'm done. My wife can talk, but she does not answer the call waiting. It drives me crazy, because I'm the only one she does. She answers everybody else's call waiting. I just know that. But when I call, ring, 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 just goes on and on as she's talking. And you know, these people that we sponsor become like our family. They become like our children. When they're with you for a long period of time, they really become like your kids. We've had them die of alcoholism. And it's like losing a child. We buried them that couldn't afford to bury themselves. It's like losing a member of your family, and we become very attached to them. For 6 years up until about a year ago, my wife sponsored this very young woman in AA. She had three kids at the time. She had two when my wife met her on a 12-step call and watched the third one be born. She's in and out of AA for 5 years. And my wife, you know, my wife would take calls from people drunk or sober. She took calls from a woman who called every day at 7 o'clock in the morning and checked in. Every single day. Went to a meeting every single day and got drunk every single night for 2.5 years. And she called every morning at 7. And I said, "I couldn't take that call. I don't know how you do that." But she took that call every day. That woman's got 5 years of continuous sobriety now because she never forgot our number and because my wife took her calls every day. I don't question that anymore. But this young woman that my wife sponsored for 5 years is in and out, in and out. She's 30 years old and she winds up homeless. He goes away, he leaves them, goes off to Florida. She's got no car, no job, no him, no money, and four kids. She's on the street. She calls and asks for help. And my wife arranged a treatment bed for her. As a matter of fact, Patty, is Patty here? Patio? She's our speaker at 3 o'clock today, was on the board to help found this recovery place down in Laguna Hills. And we got her a treatment bed down there. My wife asked me to take her, and I did. I took one of my wife's sponsees with to get her because I don't do AA 12-step work. I don't know how. Our first stop was a liquor store to get a bottle. That's not really Al-Anon 12-step work in my experience. So we could get her in the car and took her down and checked her in. And we farmed her kids out as, you know, wherever we could go with them. And about 2 weeks later, she looks like she's finally getting it. I mean, everything about her seems to be changed. My wife is going down several times a week, 2.5 hours each way, to work steps with her and to do the deal. She says, "I think she's got it. I think this is different. I think it's finally different." And one of the little girls had to leave where she was. She was with a neighbor and she couldn't stay anymore. And you know, my wife and I had to talk about kids when her biological clock got going about 12 years ago. You know, my son's 30. I've got grandkids. I was not a good dad. I don't have good memories of being a father. I got a daughter in the ground. I can never make up for the damage that I've done in some parts of my life. She wanted to have kids, and I wouldn't let her. We almost broke up about it. She got over it because I got her a dog. A puppy fixed it. And we got past the kid thing, and this little girl had to move. She's 3 years old, and my wife asked me, she says, "Do you think we can bring her here for a little while?" And I said something to her that stunned me. I couldn't believe it came out of my mouth. I said, "Her and the other one are really close in age, and they're very bonded together. Why don't you bring both the middle girls? They were 3 and 5. Why don't you bring them both home?" I don't know where that came from. That didn't come from me. That came from you. And she said, "Okay." And she went and got them. And they came like 2 days later. They moved into our house, dragging the baggage of an alcoholic home. Little girls are 3 and 5 that know what drunk is. They know the timing of drunk. They know that when the first stirrings happen in the house, they have to run to the kitchen and scream that they're hungry or they might not get fed if there's anybody stirring in the house in the morning. They know about the disease of alcoholism in a level that none of us should ever have to know in her 3 and 5. And changed our house. This lady had a 6-month deal where she could have stayed down there. She got out after 3 weeks. fine. We helped her get into a room with some with a friend of ours, and we were paying her rent under the table. We didn't want to tell her or have, you know, have her be indebted to us. We're just trying to help her get on her feet and get her kids back. And then he comes back, and she goes off to celebrate at the bar her new sobriety. And they began drunk and sober, jails and arrests and battery and stuff going on. And we've got these kids now, and they come to us and say, can we call you Mom and Dad? We're living like a family. I'm doing what you guys have taught me to do. I'm being a man in recovery, being of service to these little kids. That's all I know how to do to be a dad, because I don't have any memories of being a dad. You know, I didn't do it well. My life was about me. I'm selfish and self-centered. That we think is the problem, it says somewhere. I think it says it right in there. And that's my problem, too. My life was about me when I had kids. I didn't relate to being a dad. It was about what I lost and what I was giving up. And my wife would tell me, you'd be a good dad today. And I'd say, maybe, but I don't want to know. I don't care to know if that's the truth. I'll take your word for it, but I don't want to know. And we told them, no, you can't call us Mom and Dad. You have a Mom and Dad. And they thought about that for about 3 weeks, and they came back and they said, we're going to play a game. We're going to pretend Mommy and Daddy are dead and that you are a new Mommy and Daddy. And they've been calling us Mom and Dad ever since. And we talked to some social workers, and they said, you know what, if they do that, let them. Because you're easier to explain in their world as Mom and Dad than what's really going on. They don't have to explain their parents. They don't have to explain the disease of alcoholism. They don't have to explain being lost and afraid. And you know, I've got a five-year-old. We're driving her 40 miles to kindergarten every day. And she can't read because she missed almost all of kindergarten before we got her. She doesn't know alphabet, doesn't know numbers. But she would ask me what every sign said. 40 miles on a freeway, several freeways. She knew every sign by sight, what the name of the street was, every freeway interchange, and every intersection on the way to her school. And she asked him every day to be sure, because she's so afraid that she'll be abandoned that her method of coping with that is to know where she is at all times so she'll never be lost. And when you drop her off at school, she said, will you be coming back? And she asks it every day. And it rips your heart out. I've got a three-year-old, we're going out the door to the gym, and she looks up at me, and I got a farmer tan, you know, and she says, 3 years old, she looks up, she's got a hold of my hand, she says, Daddy, if anybody says anything about your tan, they're going to get a piece of me. We had a fight one day. We don't fight very often. You know, we got the traditions in our home. We're allowed to disagree, and sometimes we agree to just disagree and not talk about stuff. And, you know, I have safe zones in my house. That was something that came out of Al-Anon AA, where she would follow me in sobriety to share her new opinions with me, and I'd run out of my house, and I didn't think that was fair. So we agreed that there's a couple places in my home, if we're fighting, if I go and say I don't need to talk right now, that she has to respect that boundary and leave. And, you know, we've learned how to communicate. I've learned how to be a husband, and I'm learning to be a father. And we had a disagreement one day. She had something happened. She was vacuuming the house, and the circuit breaker popped, and I'm working on my new computer. And it's the same one. It always pops. If you're any doubt that she might be an alcoholic, she plugs the vacuum in the same socket every time. It's the same one hooked to the same circuit breaker that on the second stroke pops the breaker. Every time. And she does it every time she vacuums. She goes out, she knows what breaker, pops it back on, gets a couple more strokes, goes out, pops it on again. Well, about the fourth time she has a tantrum and just shuts the whole box on and off. I'm on my brand new Dell computer processing, and it goes, the hokey pokey across my desk. I'm having a heart attack. She comes storming through the back door. The little one's been in trouble. She's got behavioral problems anyway, and she's been sent to her room. And I come out of the office going, what in the hell do you think you're doing in the computer and this? And she's going to damn vacuum and the circuit breaker, and you need to fix that. And we're hollering. And the little one comes out of the room, and she says, back in your room. And the little one turns around and runs back to her room. She don't know what we're fighting about. It's all done in about 30 seconds. I go back to my office and reboot my computer, and the little one comes down the hall against our orders and comes in my office, has no idea what we were talking about, and says, Daddy, Mommy doesn't mean it. You know, I'm a pretty good citizen in a meeting. When I'm new, I could behave for an hour, hour and a half at a meeting. I couldn't get it much past the edges of that. I'm sometimes not any better than that these days. In a meeting, I'm pretty good. I might exchange greetings with you on the freeway on the way to the meeting and maybe make some gestures out the window or maybe cut you off or receive a cut off or two on the way to the meeting. But if you get off at my ramp, I would have to follow you to the meeting because if you turn into the parking lot, I got to quit Al-Anon. For an hour, I could behave. Having these kids in our home made us take our recovery to another level. We had to start acting like recovering people in our home. And I'm going to give you the, I'm running out of time, but I'll give you the condensed version of what's going on now. Another thing came out of my mouth, I've got no idea where it came from. And these little girls had traveled enough. It just occurred to me they were done traveling. And I went to my wife and I said, and we have something in our house, because of the traditions, we get to use the traditions to make decisions. That means we're going to vote on stuff. But there's two of us. And the way that we define that, if you look in our service materials in Al-Anon, it talks about a concept called substantial unanimity. That means everybody or nobody. And when we decide to take a major decision, we either all vote for it or all vote against it, or we don't take an action. If we can't agree, we don't take an action. And I went to my wife and I said, as far as I'm concerned, these kids are done traveling. They either go back to a sober mom or they stay here. They're not going to social services. They're not going to another relative. They spent 3 years living with an aunt before we got them. They're done traveling. My wife said, okay. We went to court and we filed for guardianship. The week that we went to court, there was violence. I think he got arrested for beating her up and she got put in a shelter and they're talking about coming to get the kids. So we went and got a guardianship. And they opposed us and we were successful and they finally signed off on it. And I told my wife, I said, you have to have a guardianship for a minimum of a year and then you can file to adopt. I says, if in a year they haven't gotten their stuff together, I'm willing to go for the adoption. We'll talk about it. And for a year, she's drunk and sober and drunk and sober. And 9 months of that, they didn't come see him. They called about four times on the phone. Called my wife a lot. She calls my wife all the time. She was her AA sponsor. She just was in the habit of calling. She'd get drunk and call, she'd be sober and call. But they didn't come see the kids, so we filed to adopt. And they showed up in court to oppose us. And they got their lawyers, which they get courtesy of the taxpayer. And it set off a year and a half legal battle is still going on. And we spent a house. Because it was the right thing to do. Because we didn't have a choice. We went to court. We had a 6-week trial. We won the trial on abandonment, which is the major portion of it. Should have ended at that point, but it hasn't because there's been legal wranglings to push it off. And we started running into some other problems which were even worse, and that is that we made a commitment together to make this decision. And we made a commitment together to pursue this and to spend the money on it. And you know, because of the grace of a loving God, last year in my business, for not any good reason whatsoever, I doubled my income. I didn't do anything different. It just doubled. And I banked a ton of money because we're looking to get a bigger house and a better school district for the kids because we're paying for private school and driving them quite a distance. The schools in my area are very poor. And I thought it was in there for a house. When I got the bill from my attorneys, it was almost the identical amount. It's just God laughing at my plans. And where we stand now is we had court a week ago and it's been put off another 5 weeks. And my take on it is I think that what the judge is doing is he's setting it up so that there can't be an appeal. He wants his decision to be final. And he's having to bend over backwards to allow them to do everything that they can do. And God's in charge. I do the footwork. I'm not in charge of the result. But what happened in our relationship was a lot harder to do. And that is that after we went through all of it, after we won the abandonment part of the trial, after it was all over and we both fully expected to have the kids taken away from us, and it appeared that we had won, my wife came to me and she said, I don't know if I want to do this. I'm not sure if I can do this. And we talked about it. She says, I think we ought to talk about giving them up. Now, we had made a decision together and come to substantial unanimity. I says, babe, here's the deal. We made a choice together. Now, I've made a commitment to those kids. I've made a commitment to those children's parents, to their grandparents, and to their aunt and their family, that I'm going to do this thing. She says, if you love me, you'd let them go. I says, if I loved you, I wouldn't rob a bank. If I loved you, I wouldn't commit murder for you. I don't have to do those things to prove I love you, and I love you more than anything. But the only package that I have to offer right now is a man with children, and you have to choose. And it was hard, and she went into her network. That's the hardest thing I will ever do as an Al-Anon, is allow her to do her process and to not get in it and not tell her again. My sponsor hit me right on the head early on. She said, you can tell your wife your opinion once. The second time is nagging. Oh, that hit a nerve with me. And I had to get out and let her network, let her go to AA retreats with people that we respect in the program and work with her sponsor, work with the women and come to a decision. And about a month ago, she sat down and she said, okay. She says, I don't know if I can, but I'm willing to do it today. And I said, honey, I don't know if I can either, but today I'm going to do it. And she made a commitment to stay in the marriage. And we've had... That was about 4 to 6 weeks ago. We've had the best time. Our relationship jumps up a notch. After a crisis, you know, you let go of the rock for a minute to climb, you're going up or down. You never know which way it is. We jumped up a notch. I love my wife very much. I would loathe to do any of this without her. And if she left, I'd probably lose the children anyway. I don't know if the court would give them to us. But I have to do what has been what I think is right in Al-Anon. The last thing I'll tell you is this. My wife told me I'd be a good dad. And I don't know if I believed her or not, but I'm going to tell you right now, standing here today, I'm a damn good dad. I do homework with those girls. I go to skate parties. I chaperone. I'm a good dad. And I put my faith in God that He's going to look after me and look after them. A year and a half on Memorial Day, I was going to go up and see my daughter at the cemetery where I didn't go for 12 years after she died because I couldn't go. And we debated whether to take these kids up there. They lost an older brother that they never knew, and their mom would talk about it when she drank incessantly. So they would talk about death and dying and their brother. And I'm afraid to take them to the cemetery. And my wife and I discussed it and said, you know what, we're not in charge. Let's take them. That's where we're going to go. So we went up and took some flowers, and we're dressing up my daughter's grave. And their brother is buried 50 feet from my daughter in the same plot. And my godson's four slots over where we made arrangements to have him buried when he died when he was 10 and a half, my godson. And they're asking questions, and we're trying to tell them as best we can. They're five and 7 years old. And I was cleaning off my daughter's grave, and I had forgotten that the following day was her birthday. And she would have been 25 years old. We didn't celebrate a lot of birthdays. She drowned before she was one and died before she was two. Birthdays weren't a big deal in our house, and I'd forgotten the day. It was 1977. It was a long time ago. And I started crying. The little one has emotional problems, and she's got this little hard crust on her. You know, the older one really, really just blended right in very quickly. She's got her baggage. We know she does, but she's really adapted very quickly. She loves being there. She wants more than anything to be adopted. But the little one's got that glass shell. You can't get by it. She'll come out when she wants and give you some juice, and then she gets right back. You cannot get to this child. And on pure faith alone, we took her up to the cemetery, and I'm leaning over my daughter's grave, and I start crying, and she sees it. And I got my sunglasses on. You know, heaven forbid, I still, you know, I cry in Al-Anon. Now I've cried from podiums. It doesn't really bother me that much, but there's still that little guy in the back says, it's all over. I'm trying to protect her like I know something, and she sees it and comes over, and she sits on my knee. She puts her arms around my neck, and she says, don't cry, Daddy. She'll always be right here in your heart. And why don't we say a little prayer for her? Put our little hands together and said a prayer. And that just wrecked me. But you know what happened? That little glass bubble went away that day and has not come back. It melted. She became a vulnerable, available, you know, precious, fragile little girl all the time. That bubble went away. Somehow or another, that made a contact between her and I, or her and us, that made that glass wall unnecessary anymore. And she's in the treatment of doctors for stuff that's going on, and she's on medications for it, and she's doing really good. She's been student of the month at her school. The older one's been twice. We thought she was retarded. She was so far behind in school. She was student of the month her first month. They both of them have just bloomed. And it wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for Al-Anon. And Al-Anon for me wouldn't have happened if there wasn't AA. And save a chair for the little one because she can't wait to drink beer and smoke cigarettes. She goes, can't wait. You know, my story is going to change again in another 10 years. What do you think? But my life will be forever blessed by virtue of the fact that my wife screwed up my plans and got sober. And by virtue of the fact that I ran out of enough ideas and that my ego for some reason on one day was low enough to allow me to go to place where I didn't think they had the answers, and hear a message from people who did not look like me and could not have lived a life like I had lived. And then I went there and stayed. I don't know why I got to stay. I don't know why some people get sober and some don't. I'm one of the many people that are really blessed by both of these programs. I want to thank you for your very kind hospitality, and I hope you have a great weekend.